Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Nida Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be hearing about today. Pope Benedict XVI travels to Tuscany to meet and to pray with the communities of Arezzo, Laverna, and San Sepolcro. And Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, takes us through the sixth Sunday of Easter. Pope Benedict XVI's agenda on Sunday, May the 13th, is a full one. With a bright and early start, a helicopter ride over the beautiful Tuscan countryside takes him first to the historic city of Arezzo, then to the nearby Franciscan sanctuary of Laverna, and finally to the medieval town of San Sepolcro, which is celebrating its millennium this year. In a press conference, the Archbishop of Arezzo, Riccardo Fontana, said he hoped the Holy Father would enjoy the charm of a historical church and that the trip would be an occasion to highlight concrete themes. The Pope's schedule begins in Arezzo, where he celebrates Holy Mass in the Prato Park next to the cathedral. Some 30,000 people have registered to attend. Following Mass, the Pope travels to Laverna and then to San Sepolcro in the late afternoon, before travelling back to the Vatican. A couple of days before the Pope's pastoral journey, I rang the Diocese of Arezzo, asking to speak to someone about preparations. I talked to a young Australian who lives in Arezzo. His name is Thomas Lalgire. He told me he's been involved in preparations for the Pope's visit during his work as a web and television graphics designer for the local Catholic Tele San Domenico television station.
I think it was in January that it was announced. Everything's been meticulously thought out since then. The Vescovo, which is our Archbishop, he has pretty much, you know, stayed on top of everything as much as he can. Television station has planned out all the details of how they're going to manage the visit and how they're transmitting the technical details. And I know the city itself has been going, you know, full bore, particularly in the last month. You see a lot of activities, especially where the Pope will be doing the Sunday Mass. Been a lot of activity up at the park and around the cathedral and in the cathedral where they've done a lot of renovations as a result of it. So,
tell me, Thomas, I have been to Arezzo and it's all uphill, and I read that the Mass will in fact be celebrated on a field. How is that possible?
Yeah, this is what I was actually referencing. We have at the top of the very top of the city, our cathedral, and just behind that we have a park, which is an absolutely lovely park that has an amazing view, one of my favourites anywhere, and that is where the actual Mass is being held. So they've set up, I mean, if you look at it, you could almost mistake it for a concert stage, which I actually did until I went, oh no, hang on, the Pope's coming.
Arezzo is known across the world for its beauty and for its historical importance. Your Archbishop said that he hoped that the Pope would enjoy the charm of a historical church. Can you tell us a little bit about Arezzo and what you love best of it?
Arezzo is a relatively small town by Western standards, but I think the city itself has a population of about 100,000 people, and I believe the province has, you know, something close to a million. It is historical, absolutely. Popes have been through here in the past, including John Paul II. This Pope has never been. It's a very artistic town. It's actually, traditionally, in the last 100 years, it's been run on gold. It's got a massive gold industry, and I believe the industry has actually put something together, a gift for the Pope this year as well, something made of gold. The cathedral itself was never actually completed. The inside is absolutely magnificent. It's got some beautiful artwork, and it's one of the better cathedrals you'll see. And I say that with no bias, going to have me living here, but it's just amazing. It really is. It's interesting that when such a holy figure comes to town, everything, before he even gets here, everything starts to get purified. You know, everything starts to feel cleaner, and everything is cleaned up, and everyone's ready, and there's an aura of excitement. I mean, it's an interesting experience, really, for, you know, how many of us have a Pope come to our town?
Thank you.
And among those who will be greeting Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday in Arezzo are the staff and students of the lay community Rondine, Cittadella della Pace. It's an organisation which supports young people from war-torn countries through conflict resolution and peace-building programmes, while they live together in community and further their education in Italy. Tracy McClure spoke to Rondine Educational Coordinator Ursula Armstrong about the organisation, its aims and its outreach. But first she asked whether the staff and students at Rondine are looking forward to the Pope's visit.
Oh, with great anticipation. Everyone's very excited about being able to participate. Rondine originally is based, if you like, on the Catholic beliefs and has very strong links with both La Verna and Camaldoli. So, no, they're very excited.
You talked about its Catholic history. Tell us a little bit about Rondine. How it got started.
What we normally say is that Rondine wasn't designed at a table. So it basically grew up out of an intuition on the part of a group of young Italians living in Arezzo who were part of a small church group. They began using some of the spaces in this village called Rondine for local projects with disabled people, with families, with young people in Arezzo. And as part of their work, one year, this was around the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, they decided to take a musical on the life of San Francesco to Russia. And during this tour that they made in Russia, they happened to be able to meet some very important academics and intellectuals, both from Russia and from Chechnya. And they became friends, and they were, during the really terrible conflict in Chechnya, they were asked if they could house some Chechen students who couldn't continue with their university studies in Chechnya because the university had been completely destroyed as a result of the conflict. And their intuition was to say, yes, we will, you know, have them come over to Italy and we'll house them and we'll let them continue their studies here on the condition that you can find Russian students who are willing to come over and study with them and live with them. And that was the spark that set off the whole development of the association. But it really was just an intuition initially.
So, but obviously they had some sort of success between those Russians and Chechens.
Absolutely. I mean, the very first ones who came over found it very difficult. Our president, Franco Vaccari, likes to recount that talking about living together with, you know, your so-called enemy is easy. Using words, yes, we're all for peace, you know, is fairly easy. When it comes to having to share the same spaces, share the same fridge, share the same washing machine, it wasn't always so easy at the beginning. But obviously, the first few years were a little bit more rocky. It was harder to find. We didn't have very many contacts. It was harder to find students interested. Gradually, over the years, we've developed a whole system of selecting students and talking to universities and other people in the different countries that we work with. So we have a whole series of partners that, you know, we can depend on in order to find students who are interested in the project.
Now, you have young people from all sorts of countries in conflict, kids from all different faiths as well.
That's right.
What are they like when they arrive, and how do you see them change over the months and years that they spend with you?
When they arrive, they are both excited and nervous. So, of course, they're all very motivated and interested in the idea of spending, you know, a year and a half in Italy and living with people from the other side of their conflict, people who at home they don't have the possibility to meet because they're divided by boundaries and they can't actually physically meet up with each other. When they come to Rondine, they meet them and they discover that they're young people just like them. And that's what's really great about the fact that they can live together for a year and a half is that they begin to find out that actually they have an awful lot in common. And so their motivation grows and their trust grows over the months that they stay at Rondine. And normally when they leave, they find it hard to think that they have to go back home, and when they're back home, it'll be much harder to meet up with those friends that they've made ties with.
Now, for some of these young people, it's their first experience in a Christian country. Their first impact, perhaps, with a majority Catholic secular culture. What is their reaction towards this reality when they arrive?
Normally, very positive, I have to say. Rondonet, although it's a Catholic-based association, originally it's completely secular and open to all religions. So I think it's quite, in a way, the impact is slightly diminished for them, because when they arrive at Rondonet, they feel that they're very much surrounded by all different kinds of religions, all different kinds of nationalities, and all different kinds of languages. So they're very much integrated within a multicultural context. I guess when they start going to Italian universities and, you know, having more of a role within sort of Italian social fabric, maybe they come up against the differences, the religious differences, a little bit more. But generally, they experience that in a very positive way. Certainly, you know, the sense that the Catholic communities are welcome them, I think that's generally the feeling that they get.
It sounds to me that Rondonet, in when it's putting out feelers to accept new students from different countries, that it's looking for people who are coming from more moderate backgrounds, who might already be involved in peace building or something like that. But what does that say about the people who are outside of that ambiance, who may not have any access to that sort of moderate lifestyle or beliefs?
I think you could say that at Rondonet, we try and get a kind of representation of all of the different kinds of levels of engagement, let's say. It's very important, because it's a small group of students, there are only about 25, maximum 30 students who live at Rondonet at any one time. And so it's very important to have a well-balanced group. That means that when we go and select our students, we interview students from all the different countries, and only once we've interviewed all of them do we decide who we're going to accept or not, because we try and create a group that's going to be well balanced. And so that also means choosing some students who already have a little bit of experience in the field of, say, peace building or dialogue, because they give extra motivation, enthusiasm, and ability to the students, other students who maybe initially have less experience in the field. And I think for us, it's also very important to be able to work with people who don't necessarily have experience but are interested in opening up to the people who they are separated from as a result of the conflict. In a way, it wouldn't make sense if all the students we chose were already, if you like, converted, oh, that's not quite the right word to use, but, you know, who already were convinced of the value of dialogue and peaceful coexistence. In a way, our project needs to work also with students who have an idea that that might be the road to take, but, you know, they haven't started walking along that road yet. And so we accompany them along that road and help them to see where their lives can fit into a project of peace building and dialogue. So it's very much a case of having a balance of the two kinds of people, let's say.
Can these kids make a difference when they return home after their experience at Rondonet? And I mean, do you keep in touch with alumna and what are they
Absolutely.
Telling you?
Yeah, we have an alumni association, which is called the League of the Rondonet d'Oro. The Rondonet d'Oro is the title of the award that each student gets when they finish their period at Rondonet and they graduate, if you like, and they go home. And so we have an association that brings together all the old students. It's mostly about keeping students in touch with each other, letting them know what Rondonet is working on, and seeing whether any of them can continue contributing to our work. And a lot of them do, both by coming to Italy and doing projects with us at Rondonet, also in their home countries, helping us select new students, helping us do interviews, helping us meet, you know, local politicians, that kind of thing. I think students who go back home, of course, it's not easy, but the difference that they make starts on a very personal level. So it starts with their families, it starts with their friends, it starts with their work colleagues maybe, and then gradually, you know, it goes out in concentric circles. Obviously, some students are more active attractive than others, or it may well be that their own profession is a profession in the field of peace building and dialogue. Others choose other professions, but they continue talking about their experience of randonnée as on an informal level. But no, we have some students that really have done some interesting things. A lot of them go and work in diplomatic services of their own country. Some of them have gone into local government. Some of them work in universities, for example, in faculties on peace building. So everyone, I think, manages to contribute in a little way to, you know, to furthering the cause.
And now we celebrate the sixth liturgical Sunday of Easter with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus said to his disciples, As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Live on in my love. You will live in my love if you keep my commandments, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and live in his love. All this I tell you, that my joy may be yours, and your joy may be complete. This is my commandment. Love one another as I have loved you. There is no greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. I no longer speak of you as slaves, for a slave does not know what his master is about. Instead, I call you friends, since I have made known to you all that I heard from my Father. It was not you who chose me, it was I who chose you, to go forth and bear fruit. Your fruit must endure, so that all you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. The command I give you is this, that you love one another.
There can be no doubt as to what the theme of today's gospel is, for the word appears no fewer than 9 times, love. We only have 1 word, the Greeks had 3. And in a comment on this gospel, a scholar of our time illustrates the different meanings. That of the first, eros, we might think needs no explaining, but he's very specific.
Eros is the passion of the sexual instinct and does not appear in the New Testament to designate Christian love.
Well, nothing could be clearer than that. For someone born in London, as I was, however, eros will always be the familiar winged archer in the centre of Piccadilly Circus, described underneath as the hub of the world, for it arose in the days of empire. This delightful Cupid, worthy of the golden age of Greece, as one guide has it, is a strange emblem to crown a memorial to a man who, we may read, tried to bring a little more brightness into the lives of children. The 7th Earl of Shaftesbury, described as a strongly evangelical philanthropist, was for 40 years chairman of the so-called Ragged Schools Union and a noted benefactor of these voluntary schools for the education of destitute children. In Parliament, he was largely responsible for the reduction of the factory workers' day to 10 hours and the provision of lodging houses for the poor, while his Coal Mines Act of 1842 prohibited underground employment of women and of children under 13. Shaftesbury's memorial stands in what a journalist of the 1930s described as the central scene of London's gaiety. We may smile today as he goes on.
By night, it is one of the wondrous sights of the world, floodlit with hundreds of thousands of candle power. A lovely spectacle, its marvellous electric signs must be, as Mr. Chesterton said, to those who cannot read. Noonday and midnight is all the same in Piccadilly Circus. The cafes are always open, cars and taxis are always passing by. Here is as ceaseless, as crowded, as eager a throng of pleasure-seeking people as a traveller will find anywhere in the world.
The sculptor of the Shaftesbury Memorial was never happy with the setting of his work, and when asked to surround it with a parapet, he left England in disgust, and in a letter to the Board of Works suggested they melt it down, turn it into pence, and give it to the unfortunate people who nightly find a resting place on the embankment. His suggestion was ignored. Removed during the building of the Piccadilly Circus underground station, Eros, we read, was restored to his original site after the new station was completed. Removed again during the Second World War, today he's back in his place. Eros, like the poor, is always with us. Around him, the ceaseless crowds in search of pleasure still swarm, while on the banks of the River Thames the unfortunate still sleep. The second kind of love, philia, our scholar tells us, is the love between friends. And of this love, the Lebanese poet Khalil Gibran wrote.
Let there be no purpose in friendship, save the deepening of the spirit. For love that seeks aught but the disclosure of its own mystery is not love, but a net cast forth, and only the unprofitable is caught. And let your best be for your friend. If he must know the ebb of your tide, let him know its flood also. For what is your friend that you should seek him with hours to kill? Seek him always with hours to live.
The third kind of love, agape, and its verb agapan, while rarely used in secular Greek, was, we're told, taken over by the New Testament, indicating the unique character of Christian love. In Paul's writings, it's synonymous with church, and in the letter of Jude the Apostle, it is used for the first time to refer to the Eucharistic banquet. A present-day dictionary gives us these two definitions of agape. One, in Christian theology, Christian love as distinct from erotic love or simple affection. Two, a communal meal in token of Christian fellowship. An older dictionary has a love feast held by the early Christians in connection with the Lord's Supper. Pliny the Younger, in his letter to the Emperor Trajan, tells of his interrogation of Christians, who, he writes, met to partake of food together, a plain and innocent repast. This meeting, writes Jesuit Father Herbert Musarillo, corresponds to the communion service, or the agape, and the harmless and ordinary food for which the Christians assembled, the Eucharist. The Dictionary of Phrase and Fable defines agape as a love feast, but goes on.
The early Christians held a love feast in conjunction with the Lord's Supper, at which the rich provided food for the poor. Eventually, they became a scandal and were condemned by the Council of Carthage in 397. There has, however, been some interest in restoring the agape in recent times, and in 1949 it was revived in the Norfolk parish of Hillgay in an attempt to bring Anglicans and Methodists together.
Which brings us back to our first definition, Christian love. Live on in my love, today's gospel gives us. Remain in my love, the Jerusalem Bible. Abide in my love, the Revised Standard Version. Whichever word we choose, the meaning, writes our scholar, does not have the static quality of our word remain. It indicates the situation of communion and of love, which faith in Jesus creates and favours. It expresses the intimate union between the Father and the Son, which in the believer makes it possible to bear fruit. Remain, O Christ, in the hearts you have redeemed, you who are perfect love, wrote Bede the Venerable, England's Doctor of the Church, in the 8th century.
If you keep my commandments, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and remain in his love. I have told you this, that my own joy may be in you, and your joy be complete.
In a meditation on joy, Mother Teresa of Calcutta reflects on these words and shows us how love and joy are closely linked. Naturally, our joy will be complete if we remain in his love, for his love is personal, intimate, real, living, delicate, faithful love. St. Paul speaks often of the joy Jesus himself said he had come to give. And at baptism, the priest tells the baptized soul, go and serve the church with joy. A joyful heart is like a sunshine of God's love, the hope of eternal happiness, a burning flame of God. So if we allow him to live his life in us, we will experience that joy. And if we pray, we will become that sunshine of God's love in our own home, the place where we live, and in the world at large. Joy, wrote G.K. Chesterton, is the gigantic secret of the Christian. And again, man is more himself when joy is the fundamental thing in him. Joy is the uproarious labour by which all things live. And a 19th century dean of St. Paul's warned that we must not confuse pleasure with Christian joy.
We must distinguish it sharply from Christian joy. Joy is the emotional experience which our kind Father in heaven has attached to the discharge of the most fundamental of all the higher activities, namely those of inner growth and creativeness. Joy is the triumph of life. It is the sign that we are living our true life as spiritual beings. We are sent into the world to become something and to make something. The two are in practice so closely connected as to be almost inseparable. Our personality expands by creativeness and creates spontaneously as it expands. Joy is the signal that we are spiritually alive and active. Wherever joy is, creation has been, and the richer the creation, the deeper the joy.
Perfect joy, however, as St. Francis of Assisi perceived it and recounted it to Brother Leo, is only in the cross. And as Jesus goes on from love to joy to love, he talks of the greater love which cannot be surpassed, and which he is shortly to show in his death on the cross for his friends. In his novel about the French Revolution, A Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens gives this thought to Sidney Carton, the drunkard and failed barrister, who redeems himself, dying a hero's death when he gives up his life to save a fellow being. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. In the Second World War, as in other wars, many acts of heroism went unsung. But the stories of some who showed the greater love have come down to us. In 1943, a young Italian carabiniere gave his life in exchange for those of 22 hostages. By accusing himself, though innocent, of planting a bomb, Salvo d'Acquisto was shot and all the hostages were released. Salvo was 23. In 1941, a Polish Franciscan priest died at Auschwitz after offering his life in exchange for that of another prisoner. Today, Maximilian Kolbe is a canonized saint. It's always hard to understand the motives of one who's moved to make the supreme sacrifice. But as Thomas A Kempis wrote in The Imitation of Christ, love performs and effects many things in which he who does not love faints and succumbs. The Greek doctor of the church and liturgical poet, St. John of Damascus, wrote in a prayer,
"My heart is pierced. I am consumed with ardour for you. My love for you has transformed me, O Lord. I am the prisoner of your love. May I be filled with your flesh, inebriated with your blood, which gives life, the very life of God. May I rejoice in your gifts, immersed in the joy your divinity gives. And when you return in glory, may I be worthy to meet you, and be carried up beyond the clouds of the air, united with all your elect, to praise you, give you glory and thanks and witness, together with the Father, who has no beginning, and the life-giving Holy Spirit."
And to close, let's listen to these lines from Piers Plowman. William Langland, or Long Will, as he called himself, was writing at the end of the 14th century, when the Black Death was sweeping through Europe.
"Love is the plant of peace, most precious of all the virtues. Heaven could not hold it, so heavy was love. Till it had of this earth eaten its fill, there never lighter was a leaf upon a linden tree than love was, when it took the flesh and blood of man. Fluttering, piercing as a needle's point, no armour may it stay, nor no high walls. In the gospel these words be written, 'Give, and it shall be given unto you. I gave you all.' This is the key of love. It openeth God's grace to comfort the sorrowful that are with sin entangled. Love is the leech of life. Next to our Lord, it is the graft of grace. It is the nearest road to heaven."
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. That's all from the English feature programme and from me, Linda Bordoni, today. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.